Twinkle.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, let's start with some reports. I think are of interest, economic reports, including today's jobs report. And then I want to talk about Deutsche Bank. Is it the next Lehman Brothers? Remember Lehman Brothers? At the heart of the 2008 crash, an investment bank got overextended with derivatives. Well, so is Deutsche Bank. Well, let's talk about that later on. And then I want to talk about the political news of the past week, which is the Supreme Court decision on gerrymandering and the census. And what does that all mean in a broader picture of what's happening politically in the United States and the step-by-step limiting of democracy, democratic rights, and civil liberties, and the strategies of the Democratic Party to deal with it. Okay, let's start out with the jobs report here. This is really strange. The jobs report this morning indicated 224,000 new jobs created. Now, it's interesting because it follows last month with only 72,000 jobs created. So we have this big gap and this big leap from 72 to 224. You know, there's about 125,000, maybe more, on average, people entering the workforce for the first time, looking for jobs. So if you're at 72,000, you're not even providing jobs for those new entrants into the labor force. And of course, if you're providing 224, you're doing so, new entrants, and those who either were unemployed or had left the labor force and were coming back or entering it, re-entering it, under other conditions for the first time or second time. Okay, so, you know, the 224 exceeded all the economists' forecasts by a wide margin. You know, most economists even optimistically estimated maybe 150,000, 160,000. So it comes in way above all the forecasts. And last month, the 72,000 came in way below all the forecasts. So what's going on here? What gives? How can we have such a big swing? And especially, how can we have such a big swing and growth in jobs pretty much across the board with this 224,000, except for retail, when manufacturing is stagnant, not growing? It's flat. The PMI, as they call it, Purchasing Manager Index, was just about at 50, meaning no growth. The services PMI, services jobs, services slowing down significantly as well. Housing. Housing, 15 months, new housing starts decline. How can you have this kind of a indication going on and businesses hiring so many people? You know, if it's production is slowing down, why are they adding more people if they can't sell what they've got? And then we have Canada. You know, Canada is attached to the hip with the U.S. economy, and what happens here happens there. But yet Canada, this past month, June, recorded job losses. And then we've got wages slowing down. You know, if there was so much demand for new workers, why are wages not rising? Why are they slowing? And we'll get to that a little bit shortly. How do we explain this apparent anomaly, given the real conditions? Are there real conditions in the economy, and yet we have this leap in job creation over 1 month? I mean, are they overestimating 1 month and then underestimating the next, and, you know, you smooth it out? Did they underestimate jobs in May, 72,000, and therefore they're picking them up again in June? I don't know. But it seems to me that a possible explanation of this, and others are now raising this point too, and I have for some time, is that what we're getting is the creation of second and third jobs. We're not getting the creation of, full-time jobs. In other words, new full-time jobs. These are jobs that are being added. Okay, well, then there's a category in the labor report that talks about multiple job holders, multiple jobs. Well, that's at, what, 8.2 million, I think. It's been going up. But, you know, does that official data explain it? I don't think so. I think the unofficial data is really higher than 8 million jobs, second jobs. I think it's higher than that. Look, there was a survey done by Bankrate, bankrate.com, go check it out, right, that said that now 45% of all workers, right, now earn income outside the primary job. In other words, they're holding secondary and maybe three jobs, who knows. 45% of the 162 million in the labor force are working second jobs. 48% of millennials, 39% of Gen Xers, and even 28% of boomers are earning income outside a primary job. That suggests to me that the number of people working second and more jobs is much higher than the government is indicating. And here's another strange statistic here from an independent survey here, and that is that in 2018, the average income from part-time work was $686 a month. That's the average for part-time work. Right? Now, second, third jobs are going to be, by definition, part-time. But that leaped. That went up here in the most recent data this year to $1,122 per month, average income from part-time work. How do you get an increase from 686 to 1,122, and I was almost doubling in 1 year? I don't think part-time workers got, you know, a 70% raise in pay. No, it's got to be a lot more workers working part-time, including at higher rates of pay for the first time. I mean, can you explain this by simply the Uber effect? I don't think so. Although those numbers are a lot larger than the government forecast. There was a study here about a year or so ago by the Labor Department that estimated the number of Uber drivers, people driving Uber and Lyft, were quite small. So the gig economy was quite small. But some economists dug into that and found out that, well, you know, that Labor Department survey on gig Uber drivers was only those who drove Uber as their primary job, not a secondary job. Well, come on, we know that vast majority of Uber drivers are driving as secondary jobs, not primary. So the government conveniently, you know, ignored the massive majority of Uber gig work out there. I'm sure they're doing it for other gig as well. That was a problem. I think it's a problem, too, that the government's not picking up accurately the number of new or additional second and third jobs being created. The Bankrate survey suggests that we've got, 45% of the labor force So that's like 70-some million people out of the 162 million labor force, roughly. 70-some million people are working jobs outside their primary job in order to make ends meet. Well, that's the result of the fact that wages in the primary jobs have not been increasing very much. There's another survey here, PayScale. Go check it out, payscale.com. All right, the official government data says that in the first quarter and last year, that the average wage increased by 3.1%. Now, that slowed down in the second quarter here to 2.7. But average is not what you should be looking at. And also, that average is for full-time workers only. That number, 3.1%, is not adjusted for inflation. Officially, the CPI is like 1.5%. So adjusted for inflation, 2.7 here in the second quarter, you'd be 1.2% real wage growth. But even that is an average, which means that you can have people at the top in the workforce, you know, engineers and so forth, managers, can be getting far more than 3.1%, and people who are at the median are getting nothing, and those below are going backwards. That's what average, the distortion of an average statistic, does when it comes to wages. So even the 1.2% real wage increase in the second quarter is really significantly less when you look at the median or some other segment of what's called the wage schedule. Now, it's also further overestimated because it's not just an average, it's only for full-time workers. And if we have so many of these 50, 60 million, you know, part-time, I'm not even talking about second, third job, but people who are working part-time or temp on a, you know, regular first job basis, if that's the case, they're not being counted in that 2.7, 1.2, and then adjusted for average. Well, PayScale, the survey, PayScale.com, adjusted for inflation and found that in the past year, wages have increased. Well, they haven't increased. They've decreased by 0.8% in the past year. They haven't risen by 2.7 or 3.1. They've declined by 0.8. And since 2006, declined by 9%. Well, check out the bank rate survey and the pay scale survey, and then think about the jobs report not really picking up second and third jobs people are taking on to make ends meet. Well, if they're taking on these jobs, then the government labor report's going to pick that up as job growth, not somebody getting a job. You see, the Labor Department estimates jobs, not people being employed. Yeah, well, they say employment, but they're really counting jobs. They're not counting workers who get a job for the first time. It's jobs. It's not really employment. All right. Well, you know, that gets reflected as well in another report here. Labor share of total income, talking about people who are employed, earning wages and salaries. Labor share of total income has decreased from 65% of national income to 56% today. That's been going on for decades, slowly, slowly declining. And that amounts to, estimates have been done, that amounts to every year labor's share is less by $1.5 trillion. Not, you know, since the 1960s, $1.5 trillion, but $1.5 trillion every year. You add that up over 10 years, you know, you have $15 trillion. And the way labor share of income is calculated, it's a zero-sum thing, right? If labor is down by, you know, 9% percentage points, well, then non-labor went up by that 9 percentage points, you know, because it's a percent of the national income, which is what's produced as a result of increase in output of goods and services, or what we call GDP. Okay, so labor share has declined by $1.5 trillion every year. And it's interesting that another $1.5 trillion is what will be distributed just this year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts by corporations to their shareholders. And by the way, the wealthiest 1% households now own over 50% of all the stock shares, up from 39% a couple decades ago. So $1.5 trillion. Last year, it was $1.3 trillion in buybacks and dividend payouts. This year, it's going to be $1.5 trillion because just last week, the Federal Reserve cleared the big banks to now start buying back their stock and paying out more dividends. They doctored up their stress tests of the banks and said, okay, all you guys are in good enough shape now. Now you can buy back stocks. Well, look at what's happening to bank stocks this past week. Well, they're on a tear because everyone knows the price of bank stocks is going to appreciate because now banks are going to buy back their stock. That's going to be about $200 billion this year. Estimates are for just the big four banks, $135 billion in buybacks, more for probably dividends. But that's not counting the other largest 31, there's like the largest 35 banks, and not counting the second tier banks, of which there are hundreds. Okay, so that's at least $200 billion this year on top of the $1.3 trillion, right, of buybacks last year. Buybacks last year were $806 billion or $20 billion, I think it was, plus about another $500 billion in dividend payouts, so $1.3 trillion. And this year, it's running, the buybacks are running at the same rate before. The banks were allowed to now buy back their stock. So it'll be about $1.5 trillion. Now, it's been $1 trillion or more on average ever since 2011. So buybacks and dividends, what is this? This is corporations rewarding capital incomes to their shareholders. That's what this is. And $1.5 trillion distributed every year for 7-8 years now, while wages go down $1.5 trillion a year. I'm not saying, you know, one is the exact reduction in addition to the other, but it's interesting that capital income earners are now making just from that source, buybacks and dividends. They have other sources of, interest income and rental income and so forth. But just capital gains, and now, of course, the Trump tax cuts allow them to keep more of that capital gains because that tax has been reduced. And that's really what the Trump tax cuts were all about, to reduce corporate taxes so they could give back more to their shareholders and to reduce personal income taxes of shareholders so that they could keep more of it. So $1.5 trillion for them and $1.5 trillion less for the rest. Okay. Urban Institute came out with some interesting reports as well on poverty here. 40% of American households, and there's about 135 million households, 40% are struggling just to pay basics of food and rent. 24% have two or more hardship events every year. In other words, a big bill for medical or for something. 24%. 25% have no regular work schedule. These are the part-time temp contingent workers. You know, they call in whenever they need, and they don't know from week to week what hours they got and when they're working. 20% defaulted on student loans. There's 49 million, I believe that's the number, 49 million with some kind of student loan, and one out of five has defaulted on that. 7 million are not able to pay their auto loans. They've defaulted on that. 66% have no 401k. What are you going to do when they retire? Because Social Security averages about, what, $1,200 a month? Try living on $1,200 a month. Okay, so Urban Institute surveys and data kind of reflect the dire condition of most of the folks in this country. Now, where are they largely located is another interesting question. Harvard did a study here on intergenerational income mobility. In other words, intergeneration income mobility is estimated by the children in the lowest 20th quintile of the population, by the time they are adult, were they able to move from their parents in the lowest 20, which is poverty, to the top 20th percent, or the top fifth, right? Well, the Harvard study showed that in the Deep South, plus the state of Ohio, there's no intergenerational mobility. I'm talking about, you know, the Carolinas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. Near zero, virtually zero, and Ohio. No intergenerational mobility between the mid-1990s, when they were children, to the present period here. No mobility at all. It's interesting further that the same in the South, it's the same region, the South, plus the Southwest, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, plus West Virginia, that these folks perceive they have the highest mobility. Strange, right? In real terms, they have virtually no mobility, income mobility, but their perception is that they have it. Well, you go figure out what's going on there. Either someone's convincing them of something that doesn't exist, or you know, they're misinterpreting their own condition. Okay, they think everything's great. Well, apparently they don't, because other indicators, economic social indicators, show that the Deep South and parts of the Midwest are really being hollowed out, except for the big cities, you know, Atlanta and places like that. They're being hollowed out. The jobs are gone and going. The conditions and the, you know, they don't, in some places, they don't even have grocery stores, let alone, you know, doctor and medical services. Well, that condition is, of course, fueling the red state a rebellion here, and that's been captured by Trump and the Republicans. Okay, so we have to take with a grain of salt, I think, some of this official data. Not that it's outright lying, but it just doesn't pick up the full picture. And sometimes some of these other independent, if they're you know, legitimate sources of surveys can give us an insight. But even business economists and business commentators are beginning to think twice about, gee, you know, maybe we are really just producing more second and third jobs, low paid jobs without benefits, and that a lot of folks can't live on these. And folks that have a good primary job or have a primary job, you know, are supplementing it so they're getting by with second and third jobs. But it's folks that that's all they got aren't making it. And it's showing up in other indicators. Okay. Other indicators of interest, more of a global nature here. Financial Times reported here that Europe and Japan, negative interest rates. Negative interest rates. You know, that's where if you buy a government bond or government security, you have to pay the government to buy it. The government doesn't pay you an interest if you buy it. You got to pay it an interest just for the government to hold it for you. That's a negative rate. Well, that's the result of the crisis of 2008-09 and this false understanding that if the central banks simply pump enough money into the economy and lower interest rates, that will generate investment and a recovery. Well, that's been going on even more severely in Europe and Japan than in the U.S. The U.S. stopped doing that in 2016 and tried to start raising interest rates, because the more money you pump into the economy, the lower the rates will go. But Europe didn't, and Japan didn't. It kept pumping the money in and driving interest rates lower and lower. So low that they went negative in Europe and Japan. So the Financial Times had some interesting statistics here on negative interest rates. And it showed that 69% of all government securities in Japan are now negative. In other words, you want to buy it, you got to pay the government. Negative rates. And in Europe, between 64 and 67% are negative interest rates. And globally, 24% of all government securities, bonds and so forth, are holding negative interest rates. Now, the theory was that if it's negative, then the banks won't buy government securities. They will lend instead of paying the government to hold their money. They will lend to business, and that will force them, like a penalty, to go and invest, lend and invest, right? That's the dumb theory behind that, because it hasn't worked. The negative rates in Europe and Japan have not resulted in increased bank lending. In fact, bank lending has not increased in Europe. It's still pretty much almost stagnant. Oh, banks are lending, but they're not lending to create real jobs and real investment and real production in Europe. The banks are taking their money and they're moving it offshore. A lot of it, Europe to the U.S., where rates are higher and still positive, you see. So it hasn't worked, and we're going into the next recession and financial crisis with Europe and Japan really in a very precarious, fragile position. They really have no ammunition monetarily to fight the next recession. They've shot it all off, and it hasn't worked. So why did they continue doing it if it hasn't worked? I mean, you know, if something doesn't work, try something else, right? Because they only want a monetary solution to growth. They don't want governments to spend money fiscally on social programs and infrastructure and things like that, right? That's why we have austerity, so that they could do it all through monetary policy, low interest rates and QE money injections, because that goes to the banks and the wealthy. So that's why we have that. You know, my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, a year or so ago, really punctured that myth about low interest rates. Because look, Businesses don't invest because the cost of money is cheap. They invest because the opportunity for profits, the expectations, are high. It's expectations of profitability that generate real investment. It's not the cost of the money. In fact, when you've got boom times, it's because of new technologies or new industries, and there's a lot of money to be made. And it doesn't matter what the interest rates are because the profits are much greater. So in that sense, interest rates don't drive investment. Interest rates follow investment. Well, this was understood by economists years ago, but they've lost sight of that because it's all about subsidizing capital incomes and corporations through monetary policy and tax cuts. The state is subsidizing businesses like never before in the 21st century. Massive subsidization. Look, we've passed $15 trillion in tax cuts for corporations, investors, and the rich since George W. Bush. $15 trillion. And what has it gotten us? Bubbles? Because a lot of this go into financial markets, cause bubbles. Or stagnation in the real side of the economy. It doesn't go into real investment. Today, you got to cut taxes, $4 in tax cuts to get $1 in corresponding real investment. Yeah. And that's true not just in the United States. That's true everywhere, Europe, Japan, China. 4-to-1 ratio now. As economists say, there's no multiplier effect going on here. 1/4 of 1 multiplier? That's not a multiplier. Okay, so we've got all these negative rates, sweeping Europe and Japan. And by the way, Europe and Japan are also mired in trillions of dollars, equivalents of euros and yen, of non-performing bank loans. In other words, banks lent this money to non-bank businesses, and they can't pay the principal or interest anymore. That means they're non-performing. And, in Europe, it's the Italian banks and the German banks now, and others, but mostly those, that are really, the focal point of non-performing bank loans now going on. In fact, Germany, factory orders came out today in Germany, down -8.6%, the lowest since the crisis of 2008. The German economy is contracting sharp. And Germany, of course, is 40% of the Eurozone economy. So as goes Germany, goes the Eurozone. Right? So the engine in Europe is sputtering. Germany, at the same time, they've got no gas to put in it because they've shot it all. And the rates are negative already. Money is cheap. Money is free. It's not doing anything. And you got this overhang of non-performing loans in trillions, and that's really what's keeping the banks from lending to business, and instead they lend it to financial markets or send it offshore or whatever. Europe is the sick man of the global economy. Japan's not far behind. In fact, the next financial crisis may well be centered, originating in Europe in the banking system there. Or it might come out of India. Now there's big trouble in India. The shadow banks are over there in big trouble, and the government's already trying to bail them out. And India has hundreds of billions of non-performing loans hanging over as well. Watch India. India banking system is a real trouble point, as is Europe. Of course, China is too, but China has a lot of resources and can deal with its debt and non-performing loans much more easily than can Europe or Japan or India, for that matter. Okay, one last report of interest. U.S. trade deficit You know, all this trade war going on for over a year and all the tariffs and so forth, right? You would think that the tariffs would reduce imports to this country and boost exports, and therefore the trade deficit, the U.S. trade deficit, would go down. No, it's gone up. In May, the trade deficit was $55.5 billion. $30 billion. I'm talking about the goods deficit here. $30 billion with China. And Mexico, almost $10 billion. Well, wait a minute. Didn't we oppose $250 billion in tariffs on China? And, you know, what about Mexico? Right? Didn't we do something? We just negotiated a free trade NAFTA 2.0 there. Well, Trump likes tariffs, and he promised us. Yeah, no, sorry. Trade deficit is rising. At $55 billion at that rate, you know, times 12, you're about $700 billion a year in a trade deficit. China gone up 12%, and Mexico has gone up 18%. Well, wait a minute, we imposed these tariffs. Yeah, we're paying for them, but the goods are not slowing. They're flowing still, and the tariffs are rising, and the cost of tariffs being passed on to usins, and those that might be harmed by the tariffs, like farmers in the Midwest, are getting tens of billions of dollars in subsidies from the Trump administration. And next year, election year, they'll get even more. So it will have been $50 billion in subsidies. Well, they'll take the money out of food stamps, probably. Okay, so those are some of the more interesting reports here that you won't find necessarily coming out of Trump or the government. All right, I want to talk now about Deutsche Bank a little bit more, right? For those who want a little further analysis to read, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where my blog post today is entitled, "Is Deutsche Bank the Next Lehman Brothers?" Question mark. Yeah. Well, Deutsche Bank's the biggest bank in Europe, I believe. It's an investment bank, and it attempted several years back to challenge Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and for global position here, right? And it's failed miserably, right? Is it a harbinger of things to come in Europe? Well, it might be. Biggest bank in Europe. We don't know how much it is exposed, what its losses are yet, but we do know that come Sunday, there's going to be a big restructuring announced for Deutsche Bank, and it's going to cut 20,000 jobs. And it's already selling off its better assets. Well, when you cut your costs by that much and you sell your better assets, it means that you're running out of money. You're running out of money capital. And you got to raise that money capital some way, either through cost cutting or selling of your assets. And of course, stock analysts know Deutsche is in trouble. Its stock is now selling only at $7 a share. And if we get more of the global speculators jumping in, they'll drive that down even further. And that's exactly what happened to Lehman Brothers in July, August of 2008. And like Lehman Brothers, Deutsche Bank is holding a large position in derivatives, derivative contracts. Derivatives were at the heart of the crash of Lehman Brothers and AIG, which had insurance company, which had written massive amount of derivatives on bets. Derivatives, in this case, credit default swaps, are bets that the company's stock is going to decline. Well, when you make those kind of bets and speculators buy those derivatives from AIG, they're betting that the stock of laymen was going to decline. And, of course, they went in and drove the stock down at the same time so they could collect on their dividends from AIG by making the company go bankrupt. That's what was at the heart of 2008. Okay, so as it turned out, AIG didn't have the money to pay the derivatives. They had written far more, believing that it would never happen in derivative contracts. Well, how much exposure does Deutsche Bank have to derivatives? $45 trillion in contracts, counterparty contracts, derivatives. Can it pay it off? No, there's no way Deutsche can pay off anywhere near that. Especially since its income from other sources, you know, from stock sales and IPOs and then mergers and acquisitions and all the stuff investment banks do, has been shrinking. No. Well, the bailout of Deutsche has already begun. One of the ways you bail out a bank is to merge it with another bank. They tried to merge it with Commerce Bank in Germany, but that flopped for various reasons. And now they're trying to push, in other words, the government's trying to push Deutsche Bank to accelerate its sell-off of its assets, which is it's doing right now. And now they're going to announce the 20,000 layoffs to cut their costs. And they're also going to talk about, maybe they've already begun setting up what's called a bad bank. You see, a bad bank, in Europe they do this, they refuse to do it in the U.S., they could have. But in Europe they do this. If a bank is in bad trouble, has a lot of bad assets, in other words, non-performing loans, the government will step in and take those loans away from the bank, those bad loans that they're not collecting any interest on anyway or principal, and will put it in a government created bank called a bad bank, and take that stuff, bad stuff, off of the balance sheet of the bank, Deutsche in this case, so they can survive and make loans again. And then the government slowly sells off those bad assets at some future date at pennies on the dollar, usually 10 cents on the dollar value of the asset, right? That's what happened with Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, in England, right? And that's happened before with Scandinavian banks. It's happening right now with Italian banks. They set up a bad bank and let investors, you know, the vultures, the hedge funds, and so forth, buy this stuff real, real cheap, and they hold on to it and hopes that, you know, 5-10 years from now, the crisis will be over and they can sell it at a big profit. Well, that's what a bad bank does, and that's what's happening right now with Deutsche Bank, right? But the question is, can it succeed? You know, if we have another recession, who are the buyers of this $45 trillion in derivative contracts, right? See, the derivatives channel is how the contagion spreads from bank to bank, financial institution to bank, to et cetera. Who owns, and that's exactly what happened with Lehman and AIG, right? It's beginning to look eerily like Lehman AIG. Even before we have a recession. Usually these bank problems appear as the recession is beginning or in the early stages of it. And that's what it looks like right now. Okay, so we watch Deutsche Bank and whether its derivatives exposure is the weak link that at some point, if we have another recession here, is transmitted throughout the credit system. All right. I want to talk now about gerrymandering this past decision by the Supreme Court. Interesting. Supreme Court took up this gerrymandering, which has been running amok in the U.S. You know, gerrymandering is when the leading party in the state legislature goes and redraws the districts for its representatives. And they've got so much detailed information now on how people vote. You know, this is the era of data on everybody. You know, they'll send you emails and texts and so forth to participate. They just want to get your name and your location. These representatives draw in strange ways districts that ensure their political party's representative gets reelected. You know, redraw it so the Republican district does not overlap with a Democrat typical voters, that it's only Republican-type voters, and draw it very weirdly, you know, all kinds of twists and turns and so forth in the district, right down to the neighborhoods and the streets. And that's what gerrymandering does. You know, we already have a problem in this country of very few seats are up for grabs. Yeah, out of the, you know, 400 seats in Congress, you know, 435 seats in the House, you know, there's only like 60, 70 that are really contested every 2 years. Only 60 or 70. The rest are so gerrymandered already that these people are safe. And the Democrats went along with Republicans on this for years. Only now, when it's clear that the Republicans have won the gerrymandering battle, do the Democrats cry foul, right? You know, it used to be voters would go to the polls to select their representatives. Now the representatives go to the back room to select their voters. That's what the essence of gerrymandering is. And it's one of the several indicators of the decline of democracy going on in this country right now. Another problem people aren't aware of in terms of democracy in the U.S. today is that the U.S. Constitution calls for adding representatives to the House as the population grows. That's in the Constitution. But the last time we did that was 1913. And we've had a big increase in urban centers ever since. And those states with heavy urban centers should have far more representatives than they do now. There's nothing that says you're limited to 435, you see. There were times that we had far fewer than 435. I think at the beginning of the country, it was like 60 or 70 or something like that. And, you know, it increases the population, but they haven't done it ever since 1913. Well, that gives an advantage, doesn't it, in the House of Representatives to the low population rural areas, which means, you know, the South and the Midwest, which means the red states. The red states have an advantage in the House if you haven't really adjusted the population and the number of representatives to reflect the urban centers. That's been going on at the same time as gerrymandering, in other words, ignoring doing that while you're gerrymandering the 435 gives you a big advantage to the red states. The small number of red states, of course, means that the red states, whoever can capture the small states, has an advantage in the Senate, of controlling the Senate. Yeah, that was built into the Constitution too, you know, two senators per state. So if I can capture a lot of small states, which happen to be in the Midwest and South, then I can dominate the Senate, and by the way, I can also dominate the Electoral College. So the Republicans have done just that. You see, they've totally, in the last two decades, outmaneuvered the Democrats on gerrymandering, on not adding representatives, and in capturing the small red states. At the same time, they're engaging in voter suppression. They've captured the Senate. And the Senate, of course, we've seen this since 2010, right? McConnell has, Senator McConnell, has stymied the Democrat attempts to fill positions in the courts, including the Supreme Court, blocked it, played hardball, while Obama was saying, oh, let's be bipartisan, let's be bipartisan. You know, McConnell was sticking his finger in the air and refusing to be bipartisan and then stuffing the courts, and now the Supreme Court, with conservatives. So the Republican strategy has captured the courts, has captured the Senate, and gerrymandering and refusing to add new representatives is a way that it's got the upper hand in the House. And then, of course, Electoral College in the small state phenomenon helps it to dominate the president, the executive. That's been going on. Well, this is, you know, a day after the Declaration of Independence here, July 5th today. And folks should just think about how the Republican strategy has been successful in capturing the formal institutions of government in this country, and how the Democrats' strategy has been, I don't know what's the adequate word. Ineffective sounds very polite, but deficient, no, that's not strong enough either. It's been a disaster. The Democrats have engaged in strategic failure after failure, particularly since 2001. Remember 2000? Gore versus Bush, right? Election fraud in Florida. No real protests there. No real protests. There were folks like Jesse Jackson and others wanted to go down and protest, but the Democratic Party said, stay away, Jesse. Right? And then what did Al Gore do? Agreed to just a vote count in the three counties around Miami, when the whole state should have been vote counted. The whole state. And then what happened? Well, the Supreme Court intervened and selected George Bush. Said a vote recount violated George Bush's civil rights. Can you believe that? Yeah, that was the Supreme Court back then. And then, of course, they gave us Citizens United a decade later in 2010. And now they give us the decision this past week that gerrymandering's okay. Watch the gerrymandering, already a problem. Watch it accelerate now. It's going to be even more intense than before. It's interesting, the Supreme Court, what did they do? They took up two questions at the same time. One was the census report, you know, where in the census coming next year, there's a question about asking people if they're citizens or not, you know. That's a way of discouraging people from answering the report. But also a way of reducing the population number so that the states with a lot of immigrants in them will get less money from the government for the various programs it has. All right? So that's a way of enforcing austerity in select states, you see. That was that census question about citizenship. Well, the Supreme Court took up that issue and took up the issue of gerrymandering last week. They gave a big negative to doing anything about gerrymandering. In other words, they split the decision, didn't they? I wonder why they took them both up at the same time. Hmm? Split the decision. And they said, okay, you can't have that question about citizenship on the census report. But they left the door open, even on that, you see. They left the door open pretty much saying, come back with a different question. And the Trump administration is running with that right now. Yeah. So they shut down democracy and doing anything about gerrymandering, made it look like they were given a concession on citizenship, on the census, but not really, not really. Well, that's the consequence of having lost the Supreme Court. Yeah. And look, Obama could have done something about it, you know, way back in, I forget the year when he put up his candidate, I forget the fellow's name, and Mitch McConnell, you know, would not take it up. He could have appointed that fellow in between Congresses. He could have appointed him, and then the Senate would have to unseat him, which would be a lot harder than voting him up, you see. But Obama, Mr. Bipartisan, continually sought to have cooperation with Mitch McConnell, you know, played right into the hands of McConnell. McConnell kept giving him the finger every time. And Mr. Jell-O, who is my name for Barack Obama, Mr. Jell-O, right? You know what Jell-O is? You know, you ever see Jell-O? It sort of moves left, it moves right, it jiggles around, but it never really changes its place. And that's what Mr. Jell-O is all about. That was Barack Obama. Well, bipartisanship, you know, doomed the Democrats during those years. And then we had some evidence of electoral theft again in 2004 election. The same thing happened in Ohio. It happened in Florida, you know, but the Democrats' candidate Kerry quickly threw in the towel, right? Just as Gore did. Didn't demand a count, threw in the towel. You think that Donald Trump's going to throw in the towel? Donald Trump, you know, may simply refuse to acknowledge if he loses the election and turns his minions loose. That's a possibility. The Republicans play hardball. The Democrats play bipartisanship. And, you know, so does Biden. Biden's in that that whole bipartisan tradition. Okay, and Obama, we got a weak recovery. We got an extension of the Bush tax cuts for the rich. We got a monetary policy bail out the banks and continue to bail them out. We got rising inequality. We got bipartisan. And he lost, of course, the House. And, of course, he never got the Supreme Court appointments, and we're paying for that now. And he supported free trade throughout his whole 8 years. And that just, you know, opened the door for Donald. And there was no strategy to counter the Koch brothers and so forth at the state level as they were taking over state by state legislatures. And no strategy to try to stop McConnell's obstructionism. Well, that's what we got. And then Hillary comes along, right? Hillary taking big money from Goldman Sachs and all the others. Hillary is starting a war in Libya and Syria, right? And Hillary abandoning the Midwest working class states. I don't think she even went to Michigan, and maybe one time went to some of the other states there. And, of course, those states flipped, and that's what gave Trump his victory. It was the working class in those Midwest Great Lakes states, including Pennsylvania, that were responsible. Okay, so this is the whole history. And it's going on again under Pelosi and Schumer. We'll have another show on that. Bipartisanship. Yeah. Don't impeach the guy.